Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
As I reached her secret and delicate places, I so wished that I could be the one to fulfill her. But my flesh could not. I told her I was going to blindfold her, that this would excite her and me so much more. Once she was not able to see, I summoned the gardener over. He had been hiding in her room all evening, naked, anxious, and scared, but so ready.
Projection Booth. I'm your host, Rob St. Mary, and joining me, of course, co-host, Mr. Mike White.
You know, this movie demands an Odorama remake.
And we're joined this week by Jill Nelson, the author of Golden Goddesses, 25 Legendary Women of Classic Erotic Cinema. Jill, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, guys, for having me on.
This week, we're talking about Ascent of Heather, 1980 film from director Bill Milling, written by Anthony Vincent. The film tells the tale of a young bride and groom who discover, via old family secret, that they're actually related. Still madly in love, the two kind of cope with that mutual attraction through some interesting alternatives to consummating their nuptials. The film is notable for its old-world charm and also for being the first starring vehicle for Veronica Hart. Now, Jill, you were the one who suggested that we take a look at Ascent of Heather on the show, so why don't you tell us what's the appeal for you and what do you think about the film?
I enjoyed the film. I mean, I mentioned before in different interviews that I've done, I've actually took a look at about 150 films when I was putting the book together. And because Jane really, I called her chapter thespian, and rightfully so, because she is one of the top thespians, I think, that I featured in the book, she and Georgina Spelvin. And I really was interested in taking a look at really what is considered to be her first maybe breakthrough role, her first full feature. And I was just interested to see what she would do with the material, considering it is a sex film, obviously, and her background is, theater, and she had done... She had actually done some live sex shows in New York, too. So I thought it was interesting to see kind of the tandem of those two backgrounds and how that would work kind of when she had a starring vehicle. I thought she did actually a magnificent job. She really, you know, the nuances and that she projected in her, through her character, I thought it was really beautiful and kind of sweet and charming. I when I wrote the review, I called her performance charming, and it really is. That's kind of my initial sort of reaction there to her performance in the film.
And the film feels very literary to me, as far as it takes place in this kind of, you know, old world estate, and just this whole, like, the family secret and the way they find it out. And it has a little, like, Lady Chatterley-esque feel to it to me. You know, it's kind of this Victorian, but with some really hot, steamy sex scenes to it.
And I think by casting Jane Hamilton or Veronica Hart and Paul Thomas in the title roles really helped to kind of manifest that whole kind of Victorian feel and Victorian flavor. Because Paul Thomas, of course, he actually, I mean, you may know a little bit about his background. He was a trained actor as well before he kind of crossed the bridge over to adult. He was actually in the Jesus Christ Superstar film. He played the Apostle Peter in that film, and that's kind of, and he was in Hair and different productions. So both of them bringing their talents, their thespian talents to that role, I think it really worked well, the two of them opposite one another, and kind of really, I can't imagine other people with less talent, you know, pulling that off. the way that they did.
To me, it feels like a romance novel. Like, you look at the covers of the romance novels, you see the castle, it's very, you know, very gothic, sort of, I guess, the term bodice ripper kind of thing, you know?
Right.
It has this real feel of just sort of like they knew that they were making an adult film, which obviously, you know, just the sex alone was going to appeal to men. But to me, you know, to have, you know, Veronica Hart in the lead and then have all of these elements of like the romance novel in there was like, I think they were kind of smart because I think they were trying to play either to couples or go, hey, ladies, you know, there might be something in here for you too.
I agree. It is an erotic film. And it's interesting, when I watched it again last night, I thought, oh, wow, this is it's really quite sexy. And I thought that it appealed. It's a type of film that does appeal to both men and women, I think. Whereas, you know, not all sex films do appeal to both genders. But this one really does. And I think it's maybe because, again, of the sort of romantic quality, you know, and it you know, like a Jane Eyre kind of, you know, sort of, you know, like you said, Lady Chatterley sort of, you know, flavor to it. And it's just really an interesting kind of film and really quite a, you know, when you consider what they're making today, and there would never be a sex film that would be written like that today and again, acted out in that sort of, you know, with exceptional sort of flair the way that they did all the participants there.
And the thing also is interesting to me as we're following the plot along is that, you know, obviously you have the two leads and, you know, they love each other and then they find out that, oh, well, you know, we're related, so we can't do that. And then they go off and do their different things. And you have this estate, you have this manor house. Is to me, there's this whole kind of subplot of class where there are the workers and there's like the house workers, there's sort of the people that work in the stable kind of thing, and how they interact too with sort of the lady and lord of the manor kind of thing, and how that all interplays. And sometimes people try to weave the quote unquote lower class people in so that they can be destructive of other situations. It's interesting how I think it also talks to class in a lot of ways.
Kind of along those lines, when I was watching it last night, it was funny because there's a scene when Paul Thomas, you know, he's so frustrated, you know, he wants to express his love and desire to his wife and he can't. So then, you know, as you saw, he goes to the help and tries to kind of quench his desires that way with Vanessa Del Rio. And I think the other actor, I'm not sure if that was Lisa B. I can't remember who the other girl, but it was just funny. One of the things that was kind of out of step was, I think Vanessa Del Rio said to the other girl, "You move your ass right now." And I thought, well, that kind of sort of broke the flow that the film had up until that point, because it was pretty consistent with the whole Victorian feel that it was trying to project and everything until that little bit happened. But it was just kind of funny. I thought of that when you mentioned about the help and how they were interjecting that in there and sort of, you know, like you say, you know, sort of weaving it all in and addressing that sort of, you know, that time in when people were sort of serving others, you know, in that sort of traditional way.
When I first saw this a few months ago, it was when Downton Abbey was big. And I was like, oh, here you go. Here's sort of the porn film for the Downton Abbey fans.
Yeah, I want to say that it was Tracy Adams who was helping out Vanessa Del Rio and Paul Thomas, because the only reason I remember is because Lisa B. was playing Aunt Phyllis, who introduces Jane to the wide world, which is just the sequence between her introducing Heather to the erotic world and then the subsequent scene of her and the soldier. Those two scenes, it was just like, yeah, I'm hooked, and because I thought she was really hot.
And it was very beautiful too. Didn't you think that it was just very beautifully kind of played out? I thought. I mean, there were times when, you know, you did really get sucked into the story because, again, Veronica, I always call her Jane, but Veronica in different parts too. Just the lighting and everything. She was just so exquisitely beautiful in different scenes, and I think that was part of the allure for me as well. As well as it being hot and erotic, I thought that the women were just beautifully shot, and again, the lighting was gorgeous in parts and really, really enhanced their attributes in all ways.
Yeah, I really need to get my hands on the DistroPix version of this, because the one that I saw was just so muddy in so much of it, and it was really tough to see. I ended up having to turn the brightness on my television all the way up to the top so I could even make things out, and it was just, it was really kind of frustrating. But then what I did see, you're right, the mise-en-scene was terrific. I mean, there was a part where, you know, you have this candelabra in the front, and then you have them in the background. It's like, wow, this is some really beautifully framed stuff. And you're right, the lighting on, especially on Jane, was just exquisite. And I'm a big sucker for lingerie, and seeing her outfits in this film, I was just like, wow, this is terrific.
Yeah, and especially when you know Jane's background, I mean, you, because of her having the burns. She always, and this was covered in her chapter, which she talked about, she was always very self-conscious about making sure that where she had been burned with a coffee urn in London was always covered, and that, you know, nothing would be exposed. And all of the time, in all of her films, and this one too, the costumers always made sure to conceal that so that she would feel beautiful and not have to feel self-conscious about audiences, you know, seeing these portions of her body that were scarred. And I just thought that was just really touching too. I guess because I know that about her past and her history, and I just thought it was so touching the way that she was outfitted, you know, like you say, in the lingerie, and I just thought she looked gorgeous.
You know, it's kind of funny looking at her career and Paul Thomas, and then even Robert Kerman, who was going under the Arbola pseudonym in this one, just how expansive their careers have been, both in and outside of the adult film world, is just incredible.
Absolutely. Robert Kerman, I actually believe Jane and Robert did this film, and they also did another film, Amanda by Night. I don't know if either one of you have seen that one. They just have really great chemistry. And as much as I enjoy seeing Veronica Hart and Paul Thomas, I just loved watching Jane play off of Robert Kerman. And the two of them are just great. I could imagine them doing any mainstream film or even television. They're just really great, especially when you see them, as I said, also in Amanda by Night. A lot of the porn couples were really kind of fabulous together. You know, there are a lot of different kind of porn couples that played opposite, you know, one another, you know, time and time again. It was really kind of neat to see them. And this, Jane and Robert were always outstanding, I felt.
So we talked a little bit about calling this somewhat Victorian and comparing it to Downton Abbey and Lady Chatterley and stuff. I have to say, there are a few times where I got a little confused by the timeline, because it felt like the soldier that Aunt Phyllis was betting, it seemed almost like he was from the Civil War, but then we've got like cars in there, and then when the phone rang later on, it was kind of more of a modern phone. I was like, what the hell year is this anyway?
that's porn films for you. That happens. I mean, because, you know, they don't have the budgets, you know, that of course the mainstream productions do. So they make do, and sometimes there are flaws. And I remember back then, because, you know, shooting on film, very expensive. So if there were goofs or little mishaps, often they would leave them in just because it was too expensive to reshoot things if there was an oversight or something. I know I talked to Bob Chin extensively because having written the first book, John Holmes, A Life Measured in Inches, co-written, and he would always tell us that, you know, he said you had so much money to work with. If there was a gaffe or something, or maybe if you were doing something that was supposed to reflect a certain period and you noticed after that something was off, you just had to kind of go with it, because unless you had the money to kind of reshoot it.
It doesn't have to be specific, because as Mike, as you know, it exists in its own creative universe, which is wonderful.
I can totally buy that. I don't know. At first I was thrown, and then seeing it a second time, I was kind of charmed by it. So it really kind of threw me. I guess it was just when the phone rang. I was like, oh yeah, I guess I don't know what year this is, because I kind of get so into the whole manor setting and everything that I just kind of felt like it was, you know, more like, I don't know, the beginning of the jazz age or something. I couldn't really put my finger on exactly when it was. But yeah, you're right. It is a film out of time.
It was shot between 1880 and 1980.
That's very apt. I think it's a good film for people who have not ever been exposed to pornography before. That was one thing that really interested me, because I thought, you know, you could, girlfriends of mine, I could say to them, you know, if you want to see something really erotic, and everybody's into 50 Shades of Grey or whatever, if you want to see something really erotic and depicted very well, you know, for what it is, I think it's a really great introduction to people who have had no exposure to adult films before, because of the eroticism and because of, you know, the I don't know how many days the shoot was. Jane probably remembered and talked to you about it, but it certainly wouldn't have just been a day, and there was a fairly decent sized budget. It was just interesting for those reasons to take a look at.
Okay, we're going to take a break and play back an interview we did with the star of Ascent of Heather, Veronica Hart, a.k.a. Jane Hamilton.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H. Visit adamandeve.com today.
Hello, this is Mike from the BadassesBoobsAndBodyCounts.com website and podcast. At the BB&BC website, I post thoughts, or reviews if you will, of lesser-known action, exploitation, and horror films. In the all-new BB&BC podcast, I talk about films of the same genre, but usually with a guest host. We discuss films such as...
And I'm going to let them know that Dolomite is back on the scene. I'm going to let them know that Dolomite is my name, and f***ing up motherfuckers is my name.
Dolomite, which falls into the badass category. We also look at films like...
I should have taken you for a stone-cold dyke from the start.
Screw you!
Pervert. In the boobs category. In the body counts category, we cover films like...
What's going on here? What do you think you're doing?
We're having an orgy. What's it to you?
I'm enjoying the fun.
You all think you're so smart, don't you?
Well, you ain't. You ain't so damn smart after all. You just wait and see.
Somebody's always trying to spoil our fun.
So we have a devil of a good time.
Satan's cheerleaders. And last but not least, we also look at films such as...
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
We only want to know where Valley Lodge is.
Which way do we go?
Manos, the Hands of Fate, in the Everything Else category. The BB&BC website is located at badassesboobsandbodycounts.com, and the BB&BC podcast can be downloaded from the iTunes Store, the BB&BC website, and is also now available on Stitcher Smart Radio. Just do a search on BB&BC podcast to start listening.
There is a place where rapping leprechauns rub shoulders with wrestling women and mad doctors. There is a place where domestic dwellings are terrorized by killer beds and satanically possessed appliances. There is a place where nations battle for survival whilst tasty geezers with shooters and football hooligans run riot upon the streets. There is a place where the underdog strives for sporting glory, whilst hitmen and vampire motorcycles go on curses of bloody revenge. There is a place where Nicolas Cage punches a bear in the face. The name of the place? The Crash and Burn Movie Podcast, of course. www.crashandburnmoviepodcast.co.uk. Be there. And listen to us waffle on. You may be entertained.
I've always been a performer, you know, so just remember when you take your daughter to the dance lessons and she, you know, you tell her to do those, the dance move that she just learned, and you go to the recitals, and then you go to all the school plays, and then you go to the high school plays, and then you go to the college plays, that you're basically grooming her to be an exhibitionist. You know, and I was. And the fact that I was sexual by nature, it really wasn't that big of a stretch, you know.
When you started doing the films and then throughout your career, for you, what was sort of the hardest thing to deal with when it came to shooting?
Hopefully the guy's dick. No. And if it wasn't, then that was the hardest thing. What was the hardest thing? I don't know. I don't know what the hardest thing was. There, you know, it wasn't hard. When I made the movies, I had fun doing them, and I enjoyed making them. When I stopped enjoying making them, when I'd fallen in love,
then I didn't want to do them, and then I stopped. You know, it was really simple. No force, no coercion, none of that. Is it like a job where the bosses always try to get you to do the most for the least? Sure, it's a job. They're employers, you're employees, you know? So there's always that. But it wasn't tough. I don't know what the hardest thing was. I don't, you know, long hours, retakes. I don't know. That's movie making, though. That's got nothing to do with the sex business. That's got to do with the movie business, you know? I don't know. I don't think it was tough.
It's interesting that you say that, because I just saw the DVD that's on the book for Vanessa Del Rio, and I would say that in a lot of ways it seems like you two are sort of the same now. You're like, I did this, I had fun, you know, I wasn't held at gunpoint, or, you know, it wasn't this horrible experience. And
oh, God, no. Why would we do it if it was terrible? Come on, it was great. I was having sex. I was getting to act. None of my college friends were acting at the time, and I was getting paid for it. There's a line, I'm doing a play right now. It's called The Deep Throat, The Sex Scandal. And there's a line in it where Harry Reams jumps up and he goes, that's it. I was acting. I was having sex with amazing women, and I was getting paid for it. There is a God. I mean, that's exactly how I felt about it. It was like, you know, wow. The things that I love most in life, I'm getting to do. I'm making a living. I'm becoming a star. You know, when you go into adult films, is now women go in with the idea of being a porn star, and they know that they're going to be able to have a website, and then they're going to have a web presence, and they're going to sell product, and they're going to do this, and maybe they're going to go and you know, strip, and you know, it's like more of a business move. Back then, that was, you know, it was illegal. We were kind of being outlaws, and, you know, I went into it saying, well, I'll do a couple of these movies because it seems like it'll be fun. I didn't think I was going to be a porn star. You know, that's the last thing I thought. But it happened. So there you go. It's very interesting. This is one of the only businesses where if you make one little video, you're still considered a porn star. So it's just a, you know, not every porn star is a star.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As for your name, how did you come up with Veronica Hart?
I started out with Randy Stiles, okay, because I had just come from England, you know, I'd been there for 3 years, and that was Randy, you know, as horny. I thought that, yeah, horny. Stiles was because Bernie Stiles was a casting director that I moved back to New York with, and we had a severe disagreement. So I thought, oh, this will be cool. Let me drag his name into the mud with me. And so I think I made a couple of movies as Randy Stiles, and they decided that, you know, I could act. Okay, so here's the deal. I was so lucky. I had acting training. I'd won the American College Theater Festival. I played Adela in the House of Bernard Alba at the Kennedy Center and the Eisenhower Theater. You know what I mean? I'd had acting training. I'd been acting for a long time. The girls around me, Samantha Fox, Vanessa Del Rio, Merle Michaels, Candida Royale. Well, Candace had some theatrical background. But a lot of those girls had never done acting before. They learned on the set. It was like trial by fire. It's very interesting because all of the guys, Jamie Gillis, Eric Edwards, which I just saw Eric at Freddie Lincoln's memorial last Sunday, let's see, who else? John Leslie. I don't know about John Leslie, but Paul Thomas, they all were actors, but the women weren't. So anyway, I have to hand it to them. They were amazing. I digressed. You started asking me a question. What was it?
No, that's
Do you remember
great.
Where we started?
Veronica Hart, where did the name come from?
Oh, okay. So they said, Randy Stiles is, you look more elegant. You're a good actress. You can't be Randy Stiles. You need something more elegant, elevated, more elegant. How do you like that, elephant?
At least it's not elephant.
I'm making my own words now. That's pretty good. let's see. I was, let's see, right after me in a roll call, I'm Jane Hamilton, was my given name. And after me at school was Jane Hart, H-A-R-T, and I always liked that name. And Hart is wonderful. You can do heartthrob, heart attack, heart-on. You know, it lends itself to all sorts of those corny kind of puns, of which I love so much. And a heart in England is a running deer. So Hart seemed like a good last name. And Veronica, I like Veronica, like Veronica Lake. I like Veronica from the Archies, Betty and Veronica. I like Veronica from my girlfriend, Veronica Manchot, who I went to school with. So I kind of put those two names together, Veronica Hart. And as a result, I was called all sorts of different things. I've been Victoria Hart, I know, came out in a couple of films. I think they finally corrected that. I was credited as something else. I've read that it wasn't my name, but it was me. I don't know. You know, they're not really that particular with credits.
You know, you worked a lot during what people consider like the golden age, or, you know, the great age of adult film. And I was just wondering, like, during that period for you,
I know,
career,
we were so lucky. What?
Yeah, and just like the, you know, as you
90
said.
90-page scripts.
Yeah, you had scripts.
90-page scripts, okay. And we would have 15 pages of setup for, like, a very, like, maybe a five-minute sex scene. And now it's completely reversed. You're lucky if you get 5 minutes of setup for a 15-minute sex scene. It's just interesting. And if you notice back then, you couldn't really see that much. You'd see lots of hair, and, you know, we didn't have the angles down. Now we have all the angles, but unfortunately, because we do know all the angles, what we shoot is predictable and clinical, you know? It's just kind of the same shots over and over. You see a lot, but it's like, after a while, that's kind of boring. So I think that the biggest thing about it now is that it's so predictable and boring, and if sex is anything, it should never be boring. That's a shame.
It just,
but you were going to say something else.
Yeah, I've kind of come up with a theory that when the hair went away, so did the production value in the scripts.
You know, there's a lot of people that are still trying to do stuff. It's just very difficult. We're going through like what the music business went through, I don't know, 5-7 years ago. You know, now they sell more singles, or they sell like film clips more than they sell, you know, albums or DVDs. You know, it's probably better for the consumer, because they can have every little fetish, fantasy kind of fulfilled. I mean, you know, if they want a blonde with huge boobs and a midget, they can, you know what I mean? They can probably order up that, whatever it is you want, whatever your fetish, whatever it is that you need to see, you can probably find it now. So it's probably better. But as far as filmmaking goes, nah, it's been terrible on filmmaking. If you can't make enough money, you can't spend big money on productions. It's a business. It's always been a business. So, you know, it's tough for people to make money, so they're not going to spend a lot of money on productions. We're doing more now with less people. You know, and I'm a production manager. I'm a production manager, caterer, and art director. You know, I'll come in and I'll do the sets, and I'll help the girls get dressed. I'll do the paperwork and cook them breakfast. You know, it's everything is condensed. Now the lighting, you have lighting PAs. So, you know, the technology has gotten to the point where you don't need as much lighting. You don't need a lot of the things that you used to. You need somebody doing sound, you need a good camera, and you need sufficient lighting, but it's not like the movie lighting that we're used to. The cameras now are incredible in low-light situations.
You know,
so, you know, you've gone down from like a 10- or 12-person crew to like a, you know, 5-person crew. And that includes the makeup artist. And that's a big crew. That's a big crew these days. A lot of people just tell the girls to do their own makeup, show up on set, and they're holding the camera while they're having sex. I mean, you know, there's that too. It's a different business. What pisses me off is a lot of us old farts will say that, oh, in my day it was better, or the girls in my day, and that's baloney. There's wonderful productions that still happen today. There's wonderful girls and guys still working in the business. Some of the ladies are just charming and lovely and great, and you know, so don't believe any of that. There's it's nice to, because it's not like you're used to see it or what you used to do. That doesn't, don't negate it. Don't negate the whole business, because there's great people doing, still doing some lovely things. And even if the things they do aren't so lovely, they're still great people.
When you consider, you know, the time when you were a performer, is there any particular film that you're like, this was a good one, or I had a really great time working on this one?
Well, you know, the ones that you're going to do, like Scent of Heather, that was my first where I really had the big leading role. So, of course, that will always be near and dear to me. Roommates. That felt most like acting, and not that the sex was secondary, but there's one scene there where the sex scene felt like love. I told my boyfriend, soon-to-be husband, that it felt like love, and he completely misunderstood what I was saying. He thought I was in love with the actor, and I wasn't. I just said that the scene felt like love. We were allowed to completely make love, slow, beautiful. You know, it did. It felt like love. I wasn't in love with the actor, but it did feel like it. It felt like a love scene. You know what I mean? I don't know how to express it better, but it did. It felt like love. So I love roommates. I love Amanda by Night. I think as far as acting goes, I think that's probably the best thing. So as far as The Scent of Heather goes, that's the first time when I met Arbola. And we were paired up in many, many, many movies. I think a few people called us the Hepburn and Tracy of adult films, because we did a lot of movies together. And he was a wonderful actor. He was so, you know, fun to work with. Now, when we met, we got along great until he asked me about my dad. And my dad worked out at the test site here in Las Vegas, you know, at the Las Vegas test site, which is out of town. It's like, 30, 40 miles the other side of Indian Springs. Anyway, and at that time, I would say a third to a quarter of all the people in Las Vegas worked out there. I mean, that was, you know, it was very common when I grew up for somebody's dad to be working at the test site. Well, all of a sudden, my dad became the person that was responsible for all the problems in the world. And my dad was the killer of the world. And, you know, and you can probably say anything you want to about me. I might kick you or something, but I won't get that mad. You go after my family. Oh, you are in such trouble. So, man, I got really pissed at him and upset at him. I traveled the world, and I never had that kind of reaction. I go to New York, and all of a sudden, he's basically calling my father, you know, the son of Satan, for working at the test site. And I just, oof. So we did that scene, and it was like, what's a podcast? Can you swear on a podcast?
You can say whatever you want.
So it's like, okay, I'm going to fuck you. Well, I'm going to fuck you then. I'll fucking fuck you, you fucker. That's the attitude that I went into that scene with. And it was a great scene because I was a little feisty at that moment. He had severely pissed me off. And it's funny because we ended up great friends, you know. But at that time, at that scene, I was spitting mad. He had attacked my dad. that's something you don't do. We had words about it later, and he you know, we've been friends forever. So, but anyway, I thought that would be a little interesting story for A Scent of Heather there, that scene with Arbola and I.
Yeah, that scene is great. And it doesn't come across as you're mad. I think you really transformed it into more lust and passion.
Energy. Oh boy, I was, I can vouch for the fact that I was. And it's funny because, you know, we did so many films, and we had so much fun. We loved to act together. You know, I liked acting with all the guys. Eric Edwards was my first and my last. Jamie was a great actor. I wasn't his style. He had one of those lists or something. You know, the 10 most famous actresses I work with. And I saw him later, and I go, "Hey, Jamie, how come I didn't make your list?" He goes, "You're too smart. I don't like them that smart." he's gone. John Leslie's gone. Marilyn Chambers is gone. Juliet Anderson's gone. We just lost Freddie Lincoln. We're leaving. It's like being on a conveyor belt, you know, and you keep moving up the line.
Talking about Scent of Heather, you said, you know, it was your first lead there. Do you remember how that came together for you? Did you have to go in, or did someone come to you and say, I don't know.
I just, if you want to talk to the guy who put it together, Bill Milling, he just contacted me on Facebook. It was really interesting.
Oh, that'd be great. We would love to.
So maybe I can see if he even talks about that. I think he had a very interesting background. I think he was an ex-preacher or pastor or something like that. He was a very charismatic dude. I shouldn't have said his real name. You need to edit that out. You just have to say, I talked to Bill Eagle. I think Bill Eagle was his credited name.
That's it's on IMDb as Bill Milling, so it's pretty out there. Yeah.
Okay, good. You never can tell. I'm like, you know, I have no problem with being Jane Hamilton and Veronica Hart and whoever I am. My parents, unfortunately, are now passed, so it doesn't hurt them, and my kids have always known what I do and what I've done, so, you know, it's all good. It's all good.
So you talked a little bit about Roommates. You know, you worked with Chuck Vincent for like 24 films. What was it like? What was your relationship like with him?
Oh, we had the best relationship. I didn't even know that Chuck liked me, you know, because it wasn't like, you know, we hung out, you know, but he just always used me for stuff. And it was basically what Chuck's thing was, if there was a part and he didn't know what to do with it or, you know, who should play it, he goes, give it to Hamilton. She'll do something with it, you know. And he never really directed much. He just kind of let me loose. And it was my job to make him laugh, you know. So, and I could sometimes. It was so fun sometimes. I remember one time on Cleo Leo, when I was getting dressed in the dressing room as the guy in a girl's body, like getting dressed into heels and a girl's clothes, and I got tangled up in the hanger and everything. When he yelled cut, he goes, cut! And then he just screamed, Chuck Vincent, I'm going to put the phone away from him. It's like, he would just scream. And I was just, to make me so happy because I'd made him laugh. He was wonderful. I had so much respect for him, you know. I've produced some movies, not as many as I'd like to produce. I mean, I'm a really good producer when somebody else comes up with the money. I suck as a fundraiser. I really have not done a very good job of that at all so far. So, yes, I could produce and direct, you know, when the money was there. I'm very good at that. But Chuck was able to get the deals and get his movies made. And maybe they weren't the best movies in the world, but by God, he made them. You know, he got them made. He didn't sit around and talk about films he was going to do. He did them. And he really tried to give me a break into the mainstream. We did a film together called Deranged. And I think he really thought that that was going to kind of catapult me more into the you know, more legitimate stuff, more straight films. And I know I had quite a cult following, I think, in Australia and, where was the other place? There was another place where it was actually got quite big as a culty film. So I love Chuck. He was very loyal. He had, like, you know, a band of actors that he worked with over and over. And, which is really smart as a, you know, maybe if you're an aspiring actor or something like that, and you see somebody that's got a, you know, actors that he works with all the time, and you just, you know, you think it's a bad system, but it's not, because you know how each other's works, you know each other's strong points, you know the parts that person can play, you know the parts to give them, you know what they're going to be able to do with them, and you know that you've got your ass covered. And basically, when you work low budget, you know, there's no time for fooling around, and you don't have tons of time for rehearsals or for this or for that. So you go with somebody that you know can get the job done. So I guess that's why we work together so much.
Yeah, I have to say, your role in Cleo Leo was amazing.
We had such fun. You know, that's one of the first times I know where mainstream ripped us off. Ellen Barkin did a movie called Switch after that, which was not verbatim. If it had been more verbatim, I mean, Chuck actually went to see about, you know, suing them. And the thing is, you can't, what do you call it? You can't own an idea. You know, you can own words. You can own certain things. But then I guess they said you can't own an idea. Because that was the first time I'd really known that, you know, we obviously rip Hollywood off all the time, all the parodies and stuff like that. But that was the first time that I'd ever seen Hollywood would take off on one of our films. And he didn't, the lawyer that he said wouldn't pursue it because he didn't feel that they had anything to stand on, or they got served and denied. So I'm not quite sure how that worked out, but he did pursue it, but didn't get anything from it. No satisfaction from that. You know, we made some awfully, awfully fun films. He did a lot of the late night, like Skinamax kind of style stuff. I love Chuck. I talk to him every so often, ask him how he's doing. He's been gone for so long.
Yeah.
All that that whole contingency kind of was gone. It's very interesting because I actually had a fan, believe it or not, of Jane Hamilton, because I did all those a lot of those R-rated ones under the name Jane Hamilton. Were they SAG or not SAG? I can't remember. But anyway, and I had a fan who actually said that he had no idea that I was Veronica Hart or that I ever did adult movies. And I thought that was very interesting. I didn't know anybody ever saw those movies. So, you know.
You also have worked a ton with Michael Ninn. What is he like as a director?
Oh, Michael's amazing, amazing, amazing. He's, I would say he is by far the best art director that was ever in our business. You know, he would give me a list of things that I needed to get for set. I'm going, you know, what the hell does he need this for? You know, when I go on and he'd be shooting a light through it and be making a shadow that's doing a this or a that. Yeah, he was hugely artistic and creative and, very, 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 very interesting guy. And he's still making stuff. He's still making stuff. Not as much as he was. He went through a huge legal battle with a person he was making movies for. And he fought it himself because he basically ran out of money. And he won. So, but I don't think he's ever regained the status that he had before that legal battle.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Shock and Latex. I've been trying to score him for
it. Do you realize,
years.
My boss, we work for Russ Hampshire for VCA, right? Uh-huh. Russ alone, VCA. And he had no idea what we were doing. When he found out that we shot a whole movie on blue screen, he about lost his mind. You know, there was only one set in Latex. Only one set that we used, and that was that kitchen set with Sunset Thomas and Zach.
Right.
That was the only set. Everything else was shot against blue screen and was all computer generated. He was so far ahead of his time, it wasn't even possible. Wasn't even to be believed. You know, he had that kind of insight. You know, I think he's you know, as an artist, I think he's amazing, amazing. We worked for a long time to try and get we had a company together called Hope Ranch. And an animation company. We did Playboy's Dark Justice, which was ill-conceived, let's just say that. Because people who watch Playboy, they want to see real people. They don't want to see cartoons of people. Do you know what I mean? Maybe they want to see cartoons in the magazine, but people that watch Playboy, the channel, you know, they wanted to see girls and live stuff. So we were doing all the CG, you know, character generated animation. And the fact for the little amount of money that we could do what we did where technology was at that time was amazing and phenomenal that we could do what we did. I later looked up reviews and stuff of it, and I think it was called like the worst animation in the history. And I thought it was pretty damn good. And we were doing, you know, I was doing most of the female voices, you know, voiceover stuff for it, and running tapes, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning down to the, it was something. But we tried to get a film called Descent off the ground. It came very close to getting that done. Didn't do that either. I think, again, if Michael was given some real money and a real movie, I think he could do amazing things with it. I don't know if he's pursuing that or not. We don't see each other that much anymore. You know, I talk to him once in a blue moon.
Yeah, I've asked you a lot about directors. Who are some of your favorite actors and actresses to work with?
Oh, well, Faka, because she gave me such great advice. She's been a lifelong friend. You know, the good actors, like I said, Eric Edwards, Jamie Gillis, Paul Thomas, as far as, you know, being able, Arbola, as far as being able to act in scenes. Who's my favorite people to do sex scenes with? That would be a guy who hasn't done much. You know, that would be a newbie onto the set where you have to kind of get into his head you know, the guys who had done it, they were with so many women, and, you know, it was, nothing was new to them. It's like, you know, that was just like, you know, not much there. But when you got somebody who was new and you had to help them relax and help them concentrate and find out what it is that kind of turned him on so you could help them do the scene, that sexually, that was more fun. Gals I really respect, Samantha Fox, when she was acting, not afterwards. I had an interesting run in with her on the Phil Donahue show, where I actually like felt attacked by her. She'd gone to my wedding, you know, it was very, very interesting. You know, she recanted her whole thing and how she was drunk or taken advantage of or something, you know, and she's playing the victim card. And I apologized, you know, if she had something going on at the moment, but she always seemed to be enjoying it. That's what I wanted to say, but I figured it was best not to say that on national television. You sure seemed to be enjoying it when I was going down on you. But, you know, I figured maybe that wouldn't be a good thing to say on Phil Donahue. So, you know, that was surprising, shocking. You know, I got off of it and I go, Stosh, I go, that's the last thing in the world I ever would have thought that I would have had to defend myself against you. She goes, oh, I was only trying to be controversial. It's like, oh, my God. I don't know. She had this poor gay guy who went out there before, and she just let him buy his dick, basically, into saying that he was on drugs and he was being taken advantage of. You know, he's a sweet guy. He was, like, trying to be agreeable. I don't know. I guess maybe a lot of the women go through this and they remain perpetual victims. Gee, does Linda Lovelace come to mind or not? I don't mean to say anything bad against the dead, but there are some women that come into the business as victims, as we do know. There are many abused women in all aspects of life. Are they in the adult business? You betcha. Are they in the secretarial business? You betcha. Are they in the nursing profession? You betcha. Are they in the teaching profession? You betcha. Okay? So there's a victim mentality that happens throughout. And either these women, you know, get strong and they make it. I've seen many, many women come into our business with their suitcase pimps, whether they're boyfriends or agents or husbands, and they get a sense of their power and they get some self-esteem and a sense of their worth. And those guys go, and it's lovely, and the women thrive, you know. And then there are those that can't get past being a victim, and they just stay the victim their whole lives. And it's just sad. But you can't blame the business for it. Is there scummy, horrible people in our business? Absolutely. Is there wonderful, loving, awesome people in our business? Absolutely. The girlfriends and my Club 90 that I've been with forever, Gloria Leonard, Candida Royale, Annie Sprinkle, Veronica Vera, and now new members Barbara Corella, Celinda Montano, are they the best women in the world? Absolutely. These are women that have been with over 30 years, and we're sisters, we're best friends. So, awful good people in the business. I wouldn't still be working in the business if there weren't good people here. I'm not... You know, I have a tendency not to do things I don't like anymore. So, and I do. I like working with the talent. I still like making movies, and yeah, it's a good business.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because I was going to ask you about sort of like the misconceptions. Like, what do you think is sort of the big public misconception about the business and the people in it?
Okay, there's I've got one of my best friends is a pastor, Pastor John. I was on his Christian radio program. Actually, he told me, I think, only a couple of years ago that our thing never aired on his Christian. But that's how we met. And I think the reason we get along so well is I don't expect him to... I know he's a pastor, you know, but I don't expect him to behave that way. He knows I've been a porn star, but he doesn't expect me to be that way. He knows I'm a regular person, you know. I think the biggest misconception is that we're different than other women. We're not. And I think that's a lot of porn stars believe they're different than other women. They're not, you know. Most women, you know, if you do it right and if you take your time, most humans love to feel good. We are biologically made to want to feel good. It's a biological imperative that's built in, that, you know, procreation keeps the species alive. You know, sex is not this, it shouldn't be this thing that's done to people. It should be something that's shared together. Love is, God, it's the only thing that we're down here for, is to love each other and to help each other out. I just saw a movie last night called Warm Bodies, and it was so wonderful. It's a zombie movie where the zombies are coming back to life. And what's bringing them back to life? Connection, love, feeling. They're starting to dream again. You know, that's it. What love is, what makes us human. It's that elevating factor. I don't know. I got off on a rant. But love is so important, and it's so vital, and it's so necessary for our health, for our well-being, for the survival of the species, you know. And people act like sex and all of this is, you know, some weird thing, you know, or that we don't own up to. It's very funny, though, being in this deep throat sex scandal, you know, you see that only 40 years ago, people were being prosecuted for a blowjob, for oral sex. You know, that's the whole thing that Parrish is saying, oral sex, you know, that it's this heinous crime against, you know, God and man and nature. And you know, he still believes that to this day. I just don't get it. I just don't get it. Don't blowjobs feel good? Doesn't cunnilingus feel good? I mean, unless the person's really doing it badly, I just can't imagine it wouldn't be a wonderful thing.
It's just that, it's that Puritanism that's in us, you know. It's what America was based on. You're not supposed to hate pleasure, I guess.
But it's not based on Puritanism. America was based on people who were being persecuted for their religious beliefs, so they left to be able to believe as they wanted. And we get so much intolerance now. I mean, I find I'm very intolerant of the far right, boy. I'm so far left at this point, I really have to hold an open heart and remember that most everybody just wants the same thing. We just blame it on different things. But sometimes it's very, very difficult for me to stay tolerant and keep my heart open when I hear hate speech, when I, you know, things like that. It's a test. I'm a good Christian girl. There you go.
As for you moving from, you know, being a performer to doing behind the camera work, how was that for you? I mean, when did you decide to do that?
You know, it was kind of a natural progression. I stopped doing the movies and performing sexually. I had fallen in love, and I'm the queen at rationalization and making everything work, and all of a sudden my little house of cards was falling down around me, because I'd only been doing it because I liked it and I enjoyed it. And I was really in love, and I didn't want to do it anymore. And I became very conflicted, and I really had a nervous breakdown. And my husband married me, and that was really great. And then I had to find out what I could still do, you know, because I really believed that I couldn't get out of the business, because that's where my complete income was coming in. It was kind of where my identity was at that time. So I kind of didn't see how it was gonna work. But it did. I found the things that I could do. I could still go sign autographs. I could go dance. For a while, I did the phone recordings. Not when they first came out. When they were first offered it to me, I would have made a fortune on that. But unfortunately, I got into it when it wasn't quite as lucrative, and now I don't think there's hardly any money in it at all. My husband was a director of photography, lighting director, cameraman. So it was only natural that I went to the other side of the camera. I always hung out with the crew anyway, you know. I always felt maybe more like part of the crew than the cast. I don't know. I like both sides. There's, you know, I enjoy acting. I enjoy making movies. It's a lot, you know, doing a play is a lot more fun than producing it and promoting it. I know that. Acting is a lot more fun than making the movie. I mean, yes, it's fun, but there's a lot more stress. You got to worry about overtime. If the makeup artist is showing up, oh, this gal's so late. This gal doesn't have a test. Who are we going to replace her with? I mean, Those are real headaches, real worries, you know. As far as acting, you show up, you have to please yourself, you have to please the person you're acting with, and the director, a lot easier. Being a sexual performer is not easier, you know. Guys still have it easier. If they're a good sexual performer, they're studs still to this day. And females are still sluts, you know. That's gotten a little bit better. You know, it's a little bit more accepted, but it's still the same thing. You know, guys are still macho and the chicks are still, you know. It's interesting. Now, you take this on a global. Take it on a global note right now. I'm actually working with women in China to teach them sex and intimacy. Where we are is so much farther than a lot of the other countries. And that whole Mayan calendar thing, you know, or the new beginning, I think the new beginning is the reawakening of female energy. And I'm on a mission that women should be respected and elevated, not beyond men, but at least be equal. You know, we kind of take this as a given that, you know, they're equal. And for most of the world, that's not the case at all. Women still have it so bad. I mean, you know, look what happened in India. India is the seat of where tantric sex came from the Kama Sutra. And we have this heinous thing about the woman getting raped and, you know, murdered from her eventual death. You know, you have China where women have no standing, that it's all about the men. Women are treated like ATMs. You deposit sperm into them and take their money. I mean, that's basically what they're there for. It's their culture that, you know, everything, the man's important. Even a Jewish faith, the man is everything. The man is the man, the man, the man, the man. And it's, you know, that needs to shift. We need to acknowledge women. You know, there's the whole Eastern philosophy with the women getting clitoridectomies. And that's it's tough. It's tough to change that kind of a culture when the old women of the village are the ones who push for it. Because if their daughter doesn't get genitally mutilated, she's not viable as a wife. And these are things that are global that we've got to, or I feel it, we need to be fighting for, you know. Do I care about pornography? No, I care about the right to be able to make pornography. I care about the basic right. Well, what do I care about more? I care about women coming up in the world. That's what, if my whole life of sexuality has led me to anything, hopefully it's led me to this. Wow, I didn't mean to lay it on you, but I feel so passionately about that. I feel so strongly about it.
That was great.
I really do. I really do. You know, the Latin countries that you know, women are there to basically serve the man. That is like, you know, and I understand the anti-porn people that think that all it is to serve a man. But you can, if you teach women the sex and great sex and how to initiate it and how to ask for good sex for themselves, and they actually start getting through to the men, once a man finds out how much better sex is with a willing partner who is into it, and where it's not just your basic rape, where, you know, you make love with the other person, where you don't just, you know, force in and ejaculate, it's huge. It's huge. And we can, and the way you do that, you know, it's the way tantricas have always gotten guys to be spiritual. You take them by the dick first. You get their attention with their dick. And then they evolve. They spiritually evolve. And that's what I'm hoping. Through sex, maybe we can get to these guys and make them human. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, quite a bit. Because... That's you know, as they say, you know, it's like, what is it? You know, get to a man through his stomach. I think you're probably right. It is a little bit south.
Yeah. And it's south for a woman, too. You know, they say that a, you know, woman is ruled by her heart. Baloney. Her heart's connected right to her pussy. You know, I think it's the same thing as you get guys that are with crazy women because the sex is so good. I think you get women who are with volatile guys because their sex is so good. You know what I mean? I really believe a lot of it. We put up with a lot. if something else is good.
So what were some of your other favorite things to produce or direct?
Oh, gosh. I loved Parasomnia. That was not an adult film. I got to work with William Malone and Christian Sobal, too. Bill's an incredible director, and he's just a great special effects art director person. He's amazing. Christian Sobal is a very talented director of photography. That was real interesting because that movie broke me financially. Unfortunately, I ended up putting money into it. You know, when you're like producing something and mighty people are expecting a paycheck and there's no money, you kind of get them paid. So, I mean, I was overextended anyway, but that really kind of tipped it into the Mondo Biondo. I went through that was a tough period. I lost my husband, almost lost my house and everything, and my dad, followed by in a couple of years by my mom. So, but needless to say, life has been better lately, much better lately. So, you know, it got really bad for a while, but now it's getting really much, much better. What else did I love to produce and direct? I just love working with good actors. Marilyn, I just loved. I loved. She was not happy doing the comeback films. That's not what she chose. She chose that to take care of her daughter and to financially, you know, was a good financial move for her. But that she didn't make the films because she was dying to be out there in front of people again. So that was tough. But I love Marilyn with all my heart and soul. Working with Ginger Lynn. Oh, my God. Ginger, such an actress, such a good actress. Got to work with Herschel Savage. I'm working with Herschel right now in the play Deep Throat, The Sex Scandal. He's such a fun, great actor. Chloe was an amazing, amazing actress. Julie Meadows, such a wonderful, wonderful person, beautiful, beautiful girl, great personality. I mean, these are all, with the exception of Chloe, I don't really keep in touch with Chloe, but, you know, these are women that I love and, you know, will always love. They're my lifelong friends, these relationships, these things, you know. I guess once you've been down that pathway together, you know, those friendships are huge. And the women are amazing. Nina Hartley was the guest star in this last weekend. You know, she's so wonderful. She's done so much to help with education of people, of women and everything. So, I don't know. There's just some really, 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 really great people. And I love to make things, you know. I love to make things. I make movies not because... Oh, Julie Ashton. Love working with Julie. Love working with Julie. We did a couple of really... We did Love's Passion, and God, I love that movie. That was my homage to love. That was just all about love. Who else? Oh, gosh. There's so many wonderful, wonderful, wonderful performers. The new group, the Maddie O'Reilly, Riley Reed, Presley Hart... These are all gals I work with. India Summer. India is one of my favorite girlfriends ever from this time now. I work a lot with James Avalon, who's a director for Mile High Media. And although I'm not crazy about the storylines are sweet sinners. So these are people that are always fucking end up in bed with people they shouldn't be in. Hence the titles. My girlfriend's daughter, my boyfriend's mother, my boyfriend's father. I mean, you know, just all these different titles about people that you shouldn't be making love with. They never cross the line. It's never incestuous. You know, it's never legally bad. But just morally, you probably shouldn't be screwing your girlfriend, your daughter's boyfriend. You know, it's probably as a mom, that's not the best thing to do. But... these people seem to be doing it. But what they do is it's shot very nicely, very well, and they shoot the sex organically. They get away from all the different, you know, they let the, they, sh- it's more documentary in that the love happens to them. They don't tell the performers to open up or cheat to the camera or any of that. So when you're shooting hardcore, the hardcore you get is the hardcore you get. You know what I mean? So it looks more organic, and it's more less, it feels less like all the other pornography you see.
I read somewhere that Julianne Moore's character in Boogie Nights was based on your life and career. How close is that?
No, you know, it was me and I think it was me and Annette Haven. But it's really weird because I didn't get a divorce and fight over kids. That never happened. So I know Paul had said that before, P.T. Anderson, but that's not the truth. That's not the truth of it. You know, that they're, you know, so people think that I was a drug addict and lost my children. That did not happen. I stopped doing those kind of drugs when I got married. I had a little nervous breakdown there. That was the end of those kind of drugs for me. Now, a little medical marijuana here and there I probably could be seduced into, but that's about it. And I do like a beer or some white wine, but that's about the extent of my craziness these days. So were they based on me? I don't know. Paul was a fan of mine. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful guy. And I don't know where that came from. Only the fact that maybe that I did have kids, you know.
Did you consult at
and
all?
And I don't have kids. I have men. My men are 28 and 30 this year. Can you believe it? They're amazing. They're absolutely amazing.
Did you consult at all on it or meet with them, or was there any connection to the film?
I did meet with them, and they brought everybody onto one of my film sets. Not film sets. I wasn't shooting film. I was shooting video. One of my video shoots, we were doing one of the Adam and Eve house parties. So they brought everybody down just to see how a regular, you know, porn film was set up. And they hung out for a while and watched and hung out in craft services and talked to some of the performers, and they were really cool. You know, really lovely, really, really lovely. Bill Macy's like the nicest guy in the whole world. A good story with Julianne Moore. You know, we came into, the makeup trailer together. And it was like, you know, I didn't want to say anything to her to break her concentration or whatever preparation she needed. And she didn't really want to say anything to me. We just kind of nodded at each other, you know, just kind of gave an acknowledgement of each other, and I didn't want to say anything to, you know, I was trying to be very respectful of her space, and she was, you know, very quiet, very respectful of mine, you know, and we got onto the movie set together, and something came up about Annette, and I said, oh my God, Annette's crazier than the bed bug, and she said, oh, I've heard, and we started nattering, and all of a sudden, it was like, she was like, I think she realized that I was like a real person, you know, and I realized she was a real person, and she was just wonderful. I just adore her. And anytime that we ran into each other at the different, you know, rap parties and stuff for that and for Magnolia, she was just always the sweetest, nicest, kindest. So I can only say that Julianne Moore just rocks as an actress and rocks as a real down-to-earth, really lovely, good person.
Yeah, that was pretty nice that you had an opportunity to work with Paul Thomas Anderson twice. You also were on Magnolia as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. He told me he would never cast me as a prostitute or a porn star or anything like that, that he would only ever cast me as, you know, I mean, I was like a dental assistant. My name in the credits was longer on screen than my face was in Magnolia, but he was still, you know, he stuck his neck out and still put me in. He was a great guy. And I consulted with him for Punch Drunk Love because I used to run the phone sex at VCA. And for Adam and Eve, I used to run their phone sex lines. So, you know, I got him in touch with a lot of the phone sex companies and everything. I think the gal in that worked at one of those companies. So, you know, I'm just thinking, I've met just the most amazing people through being in this business. You know, I have no complaints. I really don't. I think, if anything, I think it was really selfish of me for probably any embarrassment that my family or my sons have gone through as a result of it. So that would be my only regret, not for me, but for things that they've had to deal with. I mean, even the play that I'm doing right now, I appear for a few minutes topless, you know, and I didn't even know if they were going to be able to come and see that. But I told them the lines to watch out for. So when that came, they both had coughing fits and turned their head and they were fine. The last thing you want to do is see your mom's boobs on stage. Come on, you know? So they've been, they've had an interesting life, but I don't think it's been bad for them. They're certainly not assholes. I think they certainly hold women in a higher regard for the fact that they know that that gal who's posing nude in that magazine, who's spreading her legs on film or doing any of those other things, that stripper is somebody's daughter, is somebody's mother, is somebody's girlfriend. And I think that they get that. They grew up with that. And I think as a result, they have a higher regard for women than probably the normal person, you know?
Yeah. Just wanted to ask, you know, I mean, obviously you came in and you've said it several times, you know, it was a different business than when you came in. But if someone was interested in getting into the business, into the adult business nowadays, what would be your advice to them?
I would send them to a couple of the agencies that I think really treat the girls well. I tell them a few of the people to work with. I would do like I did at VCA. I'd ask them why. Why do they want to get into the business? If they say anything like, I mean, obviously it's a monetary thing, you know. Obviously it's monetary. It's a job. They don't call it, it's a job. It's not a play. It's, you know, they don't call it come play. It's come work. So it is a job. So it's always the money. If they say it's just the money, you know, if I say, do you enjoy sex? What I better hear is, oh God, yes. You know, this is what, how great is this going to be? I get all the sex I want and it's safe and it's with clean guys and I'm making money. Then I go right this way. You know, if they say, oh no, I don't like sex very much, but you know, I think it's a good move career wise. I will do everything in my power to discourage them. People used to ask me, what if your kids wanted to go into business? And it was a knee jerk reaction for me to go, oh God, no. I was like, fuck that. If that's what they want to do, you betcha. There's a lot worse things that you could be doing than working in adults. Both of my sons have worked in adult at some point, you know, as PAs or as production managers or as lighting grips, you know. There's nothing wrong about being in that business. And if I said there was, what kind of a big-ass hypocrite would I be? You know, it's people say, well, you want to save your children from your mistakes. You know what? It wasn't a mistake. It was a life choice. And I don't think it was a mistake. There are many other things there's not many. There's a handful of things that I've done in my life that I sincerely regret. None of them's been connected with the adult business.
Sounds good. Well, thank you for spending all the time with us. It was a great conversation.
I'm sorry I talk so much. I'm such a blabbermouth.
No, this was great.
It's awesome.
I can't help it. I'm very passionate about the whole thing. I'm really, you know, I think that's the part that I'm so happy with my life right now makes it easy for me to be happy about everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got a fabulous partner. My men are growing up, doing well. I'm surviving. I'm not losing my house at the moment. You know, things have kind of stabilized financially. I'm able to teach women and help women around the world. I mean, this is huge. This is huge. I'm so thankful. I thank God. I thank God every day for all this. I really do. So now's about the time that I should probably kick the bucket, huh?
Just when you get it together. Isn't that how it works? You get it together and then
I think
people
that's pretty
off.
Much how it works.
Right.
Yeah. Just when you got everything nice. It's that damn package you just wrapped up and put behind you that blows up, right?
Right.
Well, guys, I hope all is well in your life. Are you guys enjoying your lives, what you're doing?
Definitely. Well, get to talk to great folks like you, so this is terrific.
As you talk to them, you know, there's some dicks out there for sure, or I'm really egotistical to think, you know, that they're all that, and but the, you know, there's there's a lot of really, really, really good people involved, down to earth. Something about taking your clothes off and exposing yourself in front of people, it's like, cuts away a lot of the bullshit sometimes, uh-huh. You know? Yeah, it's hard to have a big pretense when people have seen you naked.
We're back. Thanks again to Miss Hamilton, better known to you hardcore fans as Veronica Hart, for taking the time to talk to us. It was great fun getting a chance to talk to her. And the bulk of the interview is what you just heard. But if you want to hear a little bit more, go back to the show we did last week, the opening of Misty Beethoven. We talked to her about directing the musical version of Opening of Misty Beethoven. So, Jill, why don't you tell us about your book, Golden Goddesses? How did you come up with the idea, first of all?
The idea was sort of born from the first book. In 2008, a book that I had collaborated on called John Holmes, A Life Measured in Inches, about the iconic and legendary John Curtis Holmes, was published by Bear Manor Media. I had worked on it for a period of about 3 years with a Michigan girl, half my age, and when we were putting that book together, I spoke to various, well, both of us, we spoke to various women who'd worked with John, and after the book was published, this idea started kind of percolating that it would be really interesting to talk to the women who had worked during the golden era, the so-called golden era, which is from about my book 1968 to 1985, and find out what their introduction into adult films was about. You know, how did it impact them, and where are they today? So that's sort of how my idea was. That was the kind of the conception for Golden Goddesses.
So where did it start? Who were some of the first people that you spoke to about this?
I spoke to Rhonda Jo Petty because I'd gotten to know Rhonda from the first book. Rhonda thought it was a great idea because she loved Inches and she loved being a part of it. And she said, Jill, you really need to tell the women's stories. We all have these unique, diverse stories. And I really think it's important that we get to be heard without censorship. So I thought that was really interesting. So I actually, the first interview I did was with Seika, because I'd gotten to know her a little bit through the first book too. We'd interviewed her, and I drove to Montreal and interviewed Seika in person, and she was kind of my first, being a virgin into the Golden Goddess experience. Seika was my first, and we had a lot of fun. We had champagne breakfast in Montreal and then went back to her hotel room and talked. And from that connection, after that interview, she introduced me to some of her girlfriends that I had not known before. And once she kind of spread the word, they all got on board with goddesses.
Who were some of your favorite people to talk to?
Well, I love Rhonda Jo. She's just so unpretentious and so honest and so raw. I just love her. Everybody, I think, who spends time with her cannot help but love her. Kay Parker is another very special favorite of mine, and we've become friends since I interviewed her. She is a very classy, beautiful lady, beautiful inside and out, and I really liked what she had to say. Her story is quite a different take because she really believes earnestly that her experience in adult films led her to this place of spirituality, which she's at now, and her whole life is about her spiritual life, and she is that and lives that and breathes that, so that's really interesting. You know, I like the fact that that's kind of the good that she took from that experience. And it's really hard to pick a favorite because I really love them all for different reasons. They were, each interview and connection was really special and fun, you know, just because they're so fun and they're all so different.
Sort of going the other way on that, I mean, who would you have liked to have talked to, but maybe you couldn't get to them or they're not around anymore?
A couple of the ladies who worked towards, who started into adult softcore and then transitioned into hardcore during the late 60s and into the early 70s. I would love to have spoken to Sandy Dempsey, Sandy Carey. I did feature them in my honorable mentions section. Judy Angel's another one out of LA I would love to have spoken to. I would love to have spoken to Renee Bond, but she passed away several years ago. I also did approach Mae Lynn, and we were, you know, kind of on the precipice of making something happen, but in the end it sort of fell through. Vanessa Del Rio, too. We tried to make it work, and for whatever, sometimes these things just fall apart. It's not because there's anything personal. It's just really hard to get 25 people, first of all, who are still alive, secondly, who are willing to talk about their past. So it's tough, because I know I've read some reviews where people have said, oh, I wish she'd talk to this person, that person. It's really hard to get first of all, 25 people fit within that time frame, and secondly, who are willing to kind of be open about it all.
Did you ever think about maybe expanding the time frame, or were you just concentrating on the golden age for the golden goddesses?
I just concentrated on the golden age because that is the era that really interests me. A lot of that has to do with my age. I'm 55 now. I had an older brother, 7 years older. He was, you know, a big part of the 60s revolution, and these women were a huge part of the 60s sexual revolution, a lot of them. And I found that era very relatable to me. And Jennifer, when I worked with her on the interest book, she would always say to me, I'm so glad I'm working with you because you actually lived through the 60s and 70s. I wasn't even born yet. So it was just, you know, that really was, it played a big part in that. That was kind of why my interest really lay in that area there.
Did you ever want to slap Jennifer for saying that to you?
No.
Okay.
I loved it. Because I thought, wait, that was one of the reasons that Jennifer and I work so well together, I think, is because Jennifer is she's a scholar. She's just very brainy. She's got a science, math mind, but she's also a very creative person. And we both really enjoy writing, but she was always really appreciative of the fact that I could remember, you know, what it was like when people were doing crazy drugs, you know, in the 70s, because I lived through all that. I mean, she, being a child of the 80s, she doesn't really have that kind of foundation for good or bad, you know, and she just doesn't, you know, she had no real sense of what that era would be like. So she always kind of said that as a compliment. So I always took it as a compliment. It was fun working with someone 25 years younger. It was great.
Well, that's the thing that's interesting. You know, you were talking about, you know, trying to track some of them down, considering the era. You know, a lot of these women now, they're older. They might be grandmothers. It's something they did 30, 40 years ago. A lot of people, you know, maybe not hip to talk about what they did in their youth. As you were saying, if you had such a flamboyant youth of that time period.
It's true. One of the ladies that I interviewed, Barbara Mills, she was really known as a sexploitation actress. I don't know if the two of you are familiar with her. Just a gorgeous woman, long brunette tresses, just a really beautiful girl, true hippie, you know, just pure hippie. She went down to L.A. in 68, and she got into, you know, doing some modeling and stuff, and she was an artist. And she got married and had two children, and she was so shy. When I first wrote to her, I think it was on Facebook, because Bob Chin had known her. He said, Jill, you should really try to get Barbara. And I connected with her, and she was like, well, I don't know, I'm embarrassed. And then it was actually her daughter, Carly, who is now in her late 30s, who really talked her mom into it. Because, you know, just the shame, you know, she felt shame about what she'd done. And I think actually, even though Barbara died 6 months after I interviewed her, which was really sad, Carly came to our book launch last November, and she said, my mom was so happy after she talked to you, and it kind of was like very liberating for her to be able to do that, and it just made me cry. I mean, it was, you know, and there's those stories with different women, you know, it was just very, very liberating, I think, for them to be able to come out and tell the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know, when they talk to me for this book.
I think that's great. I mean, that just shows sort of the power of sharing your story. And as you were saying, I mean, someone who might feel, because society says, oh, this is something shameful, that they feel this burden, and then they have a chance to talk to someone who understands and is interested, then I would have to say that shows the transformative power of storytelling.
I would have to agree. And I think some of them trusted me, too, because I didn't have a history in the industry. So it was kind of fresh for them to talk to somebody outside of the industry and who is a woman and close in age to a lot of them. It was just, I think it worked on a lot of levels. And I kind of came into it. I said to them, look, I'm not judging you. I just want you to be able to feel comfortable saying whatever you want to say, you know. And it was just kind of nice. It was just like having a conversation with a friend. It wasn't really like an interview. It never felt like I was really interviewing them a lot of the time.
So I don't want to steal any thunder from your book, because obviously we want people to go out and buy it. And we will have links posted to that when we post this episode. But can you share with us at least one of your favorite stories that you heard while you're doing all these discussions?
Going back to Rhonda again, it was really interesting because she grew up in Chatsworth, in California, and her dad and uncle had actually befriended the Manson gang, because her uncle was heavily into drugs, and he had actually started going to Spawn Ranch, And Rhonda, when she was a girl, she had horses. She actually had a horse, and she rode with her two girlfriends, and they would ride at Spawn all the time. And she told me that, you know, she would see Manson there all the time, and he would always be walking around with a raven or a crow or something on his shoulder, and he'd be eyeing her and the other girls all the time. But they were only about 13 at that time. But she said she feels now, if she'd been older, there's, you know, absolutely he would have tried to befriend them and get them to, you know, participate in things going on at Spawn. But her uncles and dad sort of, they had been welcomed into the fold by the family, but then Rhonda's dad was kind of driving what Manson considered to be a fancy car. It was some kind of convertible, and he started, you know, calling him a pig and kind of ostracized him from the family. And it was just kind of outrageous. I mean, I can't even imagine what that's like, but because, of course, I remember the Helter Skelter, the Manson murders, you know, when I was younger. And I mean, here she had that kind of, you know, firsthand confrontation or exposure to Manson and the group, and didn't even know really what she was involved with at the time. And everybody kind of had interesting stories. Georgina Spelvin, too, you know, had met Sammy Davis Jr. way back in the 50s before he was even well known. And he was performing somewhere where she was performing, because she'd done some Broadway stuff, and he had actually asked her where she could recommend restaurants where they served quote-unquote colored people. And, you know, so just really, you know, their stories were just, you know, everybody had something really wild to share. You know, Gloria Leonard had her own ticket on Wall Street for a few years before she entered adult films. And, you know, things that you would never think. People have this impression that these women are all just kind of, you know, railroaded into this by some big, bad, you know, horrible men, and that they, you know, that they can't make their own minds up, and that they can't think for themselves. And what I found was nothing could be farther from the truth. That is not the way that most of them got into it.
You know, in the stories, when you were interviewing with them, what did they say was sort of the biggest challenge for them when it came to working in the business and trying to do that job that they, you know, signed up to be in the films?
It was tough. I mean, it's not easy to perform sex on film. You have to be an exhibitionist to a certain extent. But also, you know, there's always someone prettier. Lori Holmes said this to me. She said, you know, even though she was in it for a short time, there's always someone younger and prettier coming along, just like in mainstream Hollywood. So you've always got someone kind of biting at your heels, and you're trying to make money sort of as fast as you can, trying to make a name for yourself, you know, kind of creating that star vehicle. You know, and then you don't want to stay in it too long because you don't want it to kind of consume you, because that's what it can do. So it just kind of finding the right balance, I think. But then, you know, there are others like Ginger Lynn, you know, who still do the odd film. She's been in the industry almost 30 years now. And, you know, she knew she was very strong. She knew what she could demand money-wise and contract-wise when she got into it. And she kind of actually started a new trend for a lot of the women. Things were very different in the 80s than they were in the 70s. But yeah, a lot of challenges just trying to get comfortable with their body and comfortable with their partners. And I know Serena said she did not like working with strangers. She always liked working with people that she knew. And back then, they often could work with people they knew because there was such a small cluster of them and a small community of people.
The subtitle of the book specifies 1968 to 1985, the 17-year window of time. 17 years is not a small amount of time at all, but can you talk a little bit as far as how things changed even within that window as far as the industry?
Yeah, it was very much in its infancy stage in 68. I mean, hardcore was really just new. A lot of them, you know, the women and men, they would show up for a photo shoot or something, and then they would be approached about maybe doing some softcore, very innocent type stuff. And then, you know, when the very first hardcore loops were made, they were often mail order. Curtis Stevens was one of the very first directors. He claimed to be the first American director to shoot hardcore loops in the U.S. and sent them out mail order. Then things changed really rapidly because obviously, the producers and people could see that there was a lot of money to be generated with this. So everyone all of a sudden wanted to make hardcore films, and they weren't necessarily big budget films. But, you know, the transition kind of happened really rapidly. And then, of course, the porno chic era kind of took hold, you know, with Deep Throat and Behind the Green Door and The Devil and Miss Jones, of course. And, you know, people, the star power, you know, element really came. John Holmes was the highest paid male star probably for a 20-year span there. I mean, he was making, you know, on a good day, $3,000 a day. That was a lot of money in the 70s. Not that he worked every day, but he worked at least 10 days a month. So that was a lot of money back then. The women were not paid as well as the men. But again, if you could get a contract, which was what the 80s really brought about, was getting they would do contracts. Like Vivid was probably one of the first companies that signed girls to contracts. I think they were actually. And Ginger became kind of the face of Vivid. Once the contracts were signed, there was a lot of money to be made, and they would get residuals and, you know, for their films, and which was really kind of unheard of in the 70s and, of course, in the 60s, too. Those things come to mind.
How do you think it compares? Was it easier for the women then, or is it easier now for women who are in the business?
I'm always kind of reluctant to answer or address or speak about the industry today because I really am not that familiar with it. But I've heard from my women, my legends, they say that today it's more about shooting scenes. And what I've been told is the nastier the scene, and one has to define nasty, but the nastier the scene, the more money, the more lucrative it is. So, you know, back then, they really were, I believe, I think there really was, if I can say, I think there was more class and quality to the filmmaking, to the treatment of the individuals that were involved in the industry. I mean, I can't remember anybody saying to me when I interviewed them that they were treated poorly or that they were treated sort of, you know, that they were degraded or anything like that. They kind of felt that they were treated well. They had hair and makeup, and, you know, I think probably it was easier back then overall, because I don't think I'd want to be hired just to do a specific scene. And I know a lot of the ladies I talked to said that that's something that would not appeal to them at all. They wouldn't want to be working today.
Now, you mentioned that you had watched a lot of movies for this book. Jill, how big is your porn collection?
My porn collection, my husband calls me, we live in a section of town, and he calls me the Aldershot pornographer. I've probably got about, I mean, I watched a lot of video on demand for this book because we had acquired a lot of films for the Holmes book. And I thought this time, I still have a lot of those films I'd like to kind of unload. But my collection is probably about 100 films now, but I had more at one point. I'm just trying to kind of wean them out. But I've watched probably well over 400, which is kind of insane.
Yeah.
I think I'm the only woman who can make that claim, certainly that I know of.
You know, that's the thing that we were talking last week. We had Heather Drain on talking about opening a Misty Beethoven. And in one of the conversations we had, and I think it was after the show, was the fact that she's like, I'm glad that you guys had me on and it wasn't like, oh, well, for a woman, you know, kind of thing. And it's like, no, it's...
Heather's awesome. Heather's awesome. I love her.
And yeah. To me, it's like, I find it great that you can be, you know, comfortable with it and enjoy it. And you can find value in it. I mean, it still seems to be a little stigmatized, a little bit, yeah, for women to be interested in porn. I mean, how do you deal with that when you've written two different books on it now?
Well, you know what's funny? I mean, I know you guys will probably laugh and maybe snicker. I'm not really interested in porn. I mean, I enjoyed a lot of the films that I saw. Actually, they were better than what I had imagined, a good number of them. But what really interested me in these two books is a human interest story. I thought, I always have been interested in kind of edgy, unusual people. So after having seen the Wonderland film, which is what sort of sparked my interest in John Holmes, and not having known anything about the adult industry, when I started watching his movies, I thought, wow, these are actually not too bad. And he's kind of had a sweetness to him. He was always very gentle with the women. And I think that made my introduction into porn pretty easy, because I thought, oh, well, this is what's so scary and bad about this. It's just erotic and it's fun. And the same thing when I watched the films for this book, I thought, you know, people for the most part are just enjoying themselves. It's beautiful, a lot of it. I don't find it offensive. Like, I don't understand what the big deal is. I don't really get it.
Well, I can definitely see that with watching A Scent of Heather, because it is very gentle and romantic and all that. You had mentioned Amanda by Night. What are some other Veronica Hart movies that you would recommend for folks if they enjoyed this one?
Oh, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, because those were actually my two favorites. Well, Roommates. Roommates is fabulous. It stars actually Samantha Fox, Kelly Nichols, and Veronica Hart, and they play three women who are trying to make it in New York. and all of the, you know, trials and tribulations. And each one of them, they are fabulous because all of them are good actresses anyway. And I would say if you want to see, you know, the trio of films for Veronica Hart, have to be those three, because I think that is probably some of really her most outstanding work for sure. And she would agree. I know she would agree. You know, I have to say, when I saw that, I think it was the opening scene. Again, it's been a couple of years, but Kelly Nichols, I think she plays like a coke addict or something, and she's having this kind of very aggressive sex scene with this guy. And I had tears rolling down my cheeks because her portrayal of this, you know, drug-addled woman was just so real. It was just so real. I thought, am I watching a porn film? Or am I watching, you know, I didn't, that's when my mind didn't think I'm watching a sex film. I thought, I'm just watching a film. You know, and the whole film has that kind of feel to it throughout. It's, the women just portray, they embody their characters just so vividly and so precisely. They're just all excellent. All excellent.
So what's next for you? Is there going to be a sequel called Golden Gods, or where are you going after this one?
Some people have suggested to me or asked me if I'm going to do a follow-up. Am I going to interview more women? And some have suggested that I interview the male counterparts. I don't know. I really want to think about it. I'm really still in the mode where I'm promoting goddesses because I want to keep spreading the word about the book. And it is a niche, you know, a niche book, obviously. So it's harder to push something like that than it is something that isn't taboo. But at the same time, I think that it definitely has its place. But yeah, I'm still kind of thinking about what direction I'm going to go next. Do I want to do another porn book? Or do I want to do something completely different? I have other ideas. I don't know. I don't want to be sort of pigeonholed either or labeled the porn biographer. You know, I want to try to branch out at some point.
Well, we're going to take a break and play a preview for next week's show.
They split.
Let's go.
Don't matter. We don't have to go anyway. Come on. Okay, she's gonna burn you.
They ain't gonna catch me now.
All they think about is cars. They're not for you.
They're just a bunch of small-town car freaks, that's all they are. They've been following me clear across two states. Three states.
Sure, we'll race. You're damn right we'll race.
For pink.
Pink slips? You mean for cars? Where to?
You name it.
Washington, D.C.
After D.C., we'll go on down to Florida. Got some nice beaches down there.
Just color me gone, baby!
We gotta get some action soon. We'll need Fred to do a little work on the carburetors and check out the rear end.
I want air conditioning.
I want air conditioning, huh?
Automatic key.
I don't want to ride a key, though.
We'll roll my bed.
We'll roll my bed.
In my back seat.
In my back seat.
I don't like being crowded by a couple of punk road hogs clear across two states. If I wanted to bother, I could suck you right up my tailpipe.
Now, this man's dangerous, officer. He passed us on the right a couple of miles back. I swear he's going about 90. He must be on something.
Take it easy, man. You're going to kill us.
That's right, we'll be back next week with Tulane Blacktop and another interview with director Monty Hellman. Thanks again to our guest co-host this week, Jill Nelson. Jill, where can folks go to find out more about Golden Goddesses and your other work?
They can go to my blog, goldengoddesses.blogspot.com, and they can also check it out on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the online bookstores. And if they're interested in my first book, John Holmes, A Life Measured in Inches, that's also available at Amazon, and johnholmesinches.com is the blog where they can go and read more about it.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on, Jill, and talking to us. Also, special thanks to our special guest, Jane Hamilton, Veronica Hart, to you hardcore fans out there. And, of course, if you want to hear more from Jane Hamilton, go back a week earlier and listen to our episode on the opening of Misty Beethoven. She has a part in there as well. Now, just have to make one more plug because we're coming up on the deadline here, Mike. VHS. Now, we've talked about adult films last week and this week. Of course, adult films are big when it comes to VHS. If it wasn't for adults, some say VHS never would have became what it became. Do you have any memories of the quote-unquote back room at the video store, hanging out around the video store, working at the video store? Come on in and give us a call and tell us your story on the voicemail. It's real simple. It's 734-666-0800. It's 734-666-0800. Once again, Mike, what are we looking for?
We're looking for your stories of VHS. Whether you're watching a lot of VHS movies, working at a video store, or frequenting one, just give us a call and leave us your voicemail, 734-666-0800. On that show, we're going to be talking to some documentarians who are talking about the golden age of VHS and all of the fun stuff that had to go along with that. Do you know how to wind a VHS movie tighter with your fingers and why you would even want to do that? Give us a call and leave us your message, 734-666-0800.
And remember, it's what?
It's free when you call for
right,
more.
Stay classy.
Well, thanks again, you guys. That was terrific. Okay, I'll go back to my porn collection now, and you guys enjoy the rest of the night.